Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. For over 30 years, Rosabeth Moss Cantor has been a leading thinker in strategy, innovation, and change management. Among her best-selling influential books are The Change Masters, Men and Women of the Corporation, and Confidence. Her new book is titled Supercorp: How Vanguard Companies Create Innovation, Profits, Growth, and Social Good. In Supercorp, Cantor looks at the emerging best practices of 21st century business and the management skills required to get there. Welcome to the program, Rosabeth.
Thank you.
Now, in the book, you talk about supercorps.
Yes.
Is that another term for what you called vanguard companies?
Well, the idea of supercorporation, it's a little whimsical, it's a little fanciful, but the idea that companies can use their unique assets to make a difference in the world, they can use the clout they have, the influence they have in positive directions. That means they can accomplish even greater things when they have society in mind and when they think of turning their power to good purposes. They are the companies in the vanguard, because I think this is the next wave of a new form of capitalism, more values-based capitalism, that will answer the concerns the public has in the United States and around the world about the direction in which companies have been heading. And it shows that there are companies who use their ability to transform themselves into powerful companies with great profits, innovation, growth, but then they use that clout for social good.
You know, it sounds like what you're saying is that the supercorp is a product of the recession. It's kind of an evolutionary thing.
I think that it's going to be more important because of the recession, but it's a 21st century phenomenon that has been in creation even before that, in the 80s and 90s, when American business was under great pressure in the 1980s to restructure, and many companies did, in the 1990s when new technology and globalization provided additional challenges. So the U.S. companies that I talk about had had the seeds of this transformation for a long time, but it's really in the 21st century. It's since the year 2000. I've seen this in companies all over the world. In the U.S., the companies that I talk about in the book returned to values, revisited their value statements, got new CEOs who were very democratic in terms of their ability to listen to voices throughout the company bottom up, and that was a source of their innovation. They're big users of the new social networking technology. So it's a very 21st century phenomenon. And in the rest of the world, the emerging market countries suddenly found that they had excellent companies able to compete on a world stage. That's also a 21st century phenomenon. American companies are partnering with companies from India, Brazil, China, and those companies are themselves sometimes in the vanguard. I talk in the book about Cemex, which is now, I think it's number two, largest cement or building solutions, they say, companies in the world. That came out of Mexico and is now a global giant, and its emergence is really in the 21st century with a big acquisition in 1999 and others in the 2000s.
Let's talk a little bit about these practices and how you would describe the supercorp as a new corporate model.
I think it's a new corporate model as it is fully realized. The seeds of this model were set earlier. Some of them will be familiar, but companies were talking about them and not doing them. So it is a new model. There are certain things that are totally new. There are other things that sound familiar, like companies have been writing value statements for a while. It's just that they would be posted on the wall and didn't mean anything. Companies have been talking about diversity for a long time, but they really haven't understood what diversity means until recent years, where diversity didn't simply mean some people in the United States from formerly excluded groups. Diversity meant a huge international mix where people had to be able to communicate and collaborate across national lines and sometimes be a virtual team. That's a new phenomenon. So some of these practices are also very new and take into account what new technology brings us and what it means to operate in a global economy. We are still in a global economy. The recession has not changed that. The recession has reduced trade a little bit and, of course, has reduced risk and investment. But the companies that I have studied are continuing to keep an eye on the future, and they know they have to sell into global markets. They will have global partners, and that's the wave of the future.
Was this a result of smart leadership that looked at the future and the need to improve their operation? How did this model evolve?
It certainly takes leadership, but in the U.S., we often have a cult of the leader, like it's got to be a single CEO. And I can certainly point to CEOs, but some of the best companies operate as teams. And in fact, the recent transition at Procter & Gamble from A.G. Lafley as CEO to Bob McDonald as CEO is a very smooth transition because they've operated as a team for years. And in some of the more interesting examples, it's emerging companies in parts of the world that looked at the best practices they could find and actually adopted them and then tried to improve upon them. For example, an Asian company, a Korean bank, which is the largest financial group in Korea, emerged in recent years from an entrepreneurial company that bought a much larger bank and simply decided that human values mattered. They looked around to see why mergers fail, and then they actually tried to improve upon what they saw were the best examples of companies that made mergers succeed. I can't point to the name of a CEO. In fact, different people were in the CEO role during this period, but they definitely operated as a team at the top, and they definitely looked at how they could be world-class even while operating in Korea, and how they could be responsible to their society by being the best bank they possibly could. And that's responsible for stunning success. They grew exponentially, outperforming the Korean stock market. And in the financial crisis, they outperformed their peers, even though, of course, everyone, especially in banking, has lost some ground. They're ready to move into other countries. And they're a great model for us in the United States.
Rosabeth, what are some strategic factors that contributed to the success of Supercorps?
One important strategic factor is never forgetting the larger purpose of the company and having the idea that serving society is part of that business purpose at the core. That helps make smart decisions and helps entice the best partners. For example, there's a Japanese company, Omron. They're a controls company. They make various things that control systems through electronic devices. That company has always looked for new product ideas, new lines of business, by examining the needs of society in a way that's more than just the marketing department doing a little research. It's saying, what are the trends, what are the phenomena that are going to make a difference, then building businesses around it. So they're now working on biosensors for food safety. They're working on solar controls. Every day, in many of their offices around the world, people will look at the motto, which says, making a better world, serving society. It's possible to be a little skeptical about that, but by the time we interviewed 350 people, we found people truly believe they have a mission that they must not only be ethical and responsible, but they must look for new solutions. And this triggers a great deal of innovation, and it also helps them make wise strategic choices. There's a wonderful example from Procter & Gamble about a product that did not work as a commercial product, but because of the P&G values, was seen as so important to P&G's mission that they kept it alive by forming a nonprofit to produce and distribute the product. The product is water purification sachets, a powder that's quite amazing. You put it into muddy water, and it cleans up the water within 20 minutes. This is a major contribution to the world, because in other parts of the world, clean, safe drinking water is a big issue. They had trouble making it a commercial success, even though it was sold at very low prices that even poor people could afford, because it required a change in behavior and habits. So it was controversial what to do with the product. But because of the P&G values, there were many people who argued that P&G had to keep making it available regardless. So in collaboration with some very big NGOs, Population International, the Centers for Disease Control, a government organization in the United States, UN agencies, they created a nonprofit called Children's Safe Drinking Water and continued to distribute this product. They've won awards and gotten enormous publicity for this because it's such an important contribution to the world. And that's an example of a strategic choice made because of values that has had an impact on the motivation of people in Procter & Gamble, has had an impact on other innovators in Procter & Gamble because they truly believe their purpose is to find innovations that improve people's lives. And in doing that, they're making a lot of money. They're now the biggest consumer products company in the world.
Rosabeth, in the book, you write about the role that public diplomacy has played for these companies. Would this be an example of that?
Children's Safe Drinking Water was part of the mission of the company to contribute. Public diplomacy also is important to companies in the sense that they've got to make relationships with public officials and get the goodwill of people in any location if they want to sell products into that location. Public diplomacy is being able to show the representatives of the public that you're not simply there to make money, but that you also are going to contribute something of value to the public and to the community. Now, if you're IBM, you're big enough that you get to sit at the table if you do that with government officials as they're thinking about what their technology policy or their privacy policy should be. But even if you're a small company, it makes a big difference. I have had many conversations with the former CEO of what's now a very, very large national retail chain about why they were so successful, and it was on the same philosophy. They never went into a new community simply to buy real estate and set up shop. They also spent time paying attention to what the needs were of the people around them, what they valued, how they could make a contribution, even a small one, to those causes. That kind of public diplomacy is increasingly part of the repertoire of every good company. I had an IBM executive in Latin America, he's from Brazil, say to me, 20 years ago, we never looked at anything outside the walls of the company. Now, we look at how we serve society. It's a refreshing change, and it means when I go home at night, I know that my family and my neighborhood are also part of the picture for my company. I don't have to leave my values or my concern for what happens to Brazil at the door of the company and only think about technology. Now I can use technology to think about how to contribute to schools in Brazil. And the same thing if you live in Kansas City or St. Louis or Cleveland, Ohio, or Detroit, where that's really an issue now, or Miami, Florida. The fact that the company gets involved in thinking about its neighborhood is a very important new idea for many companies, although there have always been companies that have made contributions. Now this is central to the thinking of top management.
You said earlier one of the things that you discovered was that some of these companies have determined new ways of handling mergers and acquisitions, and even innovations. So growth is still very much an objective for these companies, and profit is still an important factor.
Yes.
Now, what kind of changes have been discovered in mergers and acquisitions or in innovations?
Growth and profits are incredibly important. You don't have a sustainable enterprise without them, but they are pursuing them with a sense of their social purpose, social mission, humanistic values. They put a social logic next to the economic logic and say we will actually do better in terms of profits and growth if we lead with our values. So in the case of mergers and acquisitions, the Japanese company Omron, for example, has been the preferred acquirer of privately held small companies because of its values. They acquired a Silicon Valley company that was doing very well and had a lot of other companies pursuing it. But because the Japanese company had a very similar philosophy and started their meetings by talking about philosophy, not talking about money, the Silicon Valley company preferred them as the buyer. So first of all, you get an acquisition advantage because people, especially in privately held or smaller or family-owned companies, want to make sure that the thing they've built is going to be in good hands. Secondly, it's possible to make relationships because of partnerships in the nonprofit world that result in new contacts for possible business partnerships. It's much easier for executives to make relationships that don't look greedy or instrumental when they are serving together on a nonprofit board with another company, and it leads naturally into how we can create business partnerships. Then there's how these companies handle the companies they buy. So, for example, the global advertising and communications group, Publicis, which is based in France but is global in scope, has bought some very big United States advertising agencies, and it's become a very big force in the U.S. as well as in Europe. They bought one agency in San Francisco that was highly creative, very successful, and the founder turned down everybody else but went to Publicis because of how they were treated in a humane, humanistic way. And then, because advertising agencies are very creative, very independent, you don't want to lose the good people, Publicis, which was coming out of France and knew that it needed to learn from the success of U.S. companies, treated them in part like reverse takeovers, as though they were being taken over by the companies they bought. The executives approached them in a very humble way to learn from them. Humility, the ability to suppress ego, the ability to say that we have a larger cause and together we will become a great company, is a very important characteristic of leaders in the vanguard companies that helps them attract partners, make partnerships, integrate acquisitions very smoothly without the losses that practically every other company incurs when they make an acquisition.
You're offering this wonderful opportunity for corporations, and I'm sure that many of our listeners are just wondering how they can get started in changing their companies.
One way to start is to have a dialogue with the entire workforce about what matters to them, what the values of the company should be. Even if you have them, hold a dialogue about what they mean. That's a good first step. You can do it on very big scale. You don't have to be a small company with 100 employees, all of whom can fit into one cafeteria. IBM has almost 400,000 employees, and they have been engaging them in dialogue about values, but also about business priorities since 2003. In 2003, they called it a values jam, a three-day web chat open to every employee. They had about 140,000 people make comments, and the question was, what should IBM's values be for the next century? IBM had a set of values that had been laid down almost 100 years ago. It was old values, and it was time to refresh them. The CEO, Sam Palmisano, said, we can't lay these down from the top, not in today's environment, not with social networking and people feeling empowered, people who are talented professionals who would be cynical about anything that came from top management. So a group of staff took all of the responses and boiled them down to three new values. It was amazing. We were probably in almost 20 IBM locations, many in the U.S., but all over the world. And everywhere we went, people would talk about how they made decisions based on them. They're very general, but because people were engaged in the conversation, they became real to the people. It was a theme echoed everywhere. So the fact that people were engaged from all over the world in that conversation, that's a really interesting and good starting point. From that, you need a few demonstration practices. Symbols and signals are very important. The top leaders show what they mean by what they do. So things like P&G's decision about children's safe drinking water became a story told everywhere in the company that makes people proud. There's a bank that was committed to greener practices and new lending products that were based on helping people make the transition to saving energy, greener practices in general. And the bank's leaders suddenly realized that the alley next door to the bank was an eyesore. So they set up a project to fix it up, and that became the symbol that they were really dedicated to what they said their strategy was.
I can see where having these values shared with the employees, actually created with the employees, can then lead to more dedicated effort in action plans.
It definitely is highly motivating to people. The new workforce is looking for more than just a job. They're looking for something meaningful, and that's true all over the world. The most highly desired professionals, the talented people, now expect it. It's now built into the practices of Vanguard companies that people will have release time for community service. Some of the consulting firms that hire the most talented MBA students start out the orientation with service days. This is beginning to be the best way to motivate a workforce, but it's also the best way to train leaders. Send them out to do community projects where they have to solve problems in a difficult environment. They have to make new relationships. They have to bond as a team to do that, and you are training future leaders. If you're a big enough company that you have international operations, send some of your best U.S. employees to other countries to do that, and you'll find that you not only have committed, motivated employees, but you also are giving people leadership skills that get you more leaders at lower levels, able to make better decisions, more aware of market conditions, more aware of opportunities to use the company's products or services to make a difference, with a wider base of relationships throughout the company. And that's what you need for the future.
Well, there's no question that the kind of organizations these vanguards are actually makes for a better world in the future.
Yes. The products come and go. Business transactions come and go. But what endures is the culture, the capabilities, the sustained effort to make change. This is a better way to guarantee profits and growth in the future, because what managers are attuned to is building the institution, not just today's portfolio of products. These companies are very good at changing, and they are high performers. IBM outperformed the industry in the worst days just after the crash. Now, they're not going to be perfect. They're not always going to be number one, but they're going to be strong for a very long time. And that's really the point. Today's profits are one thing, but the ability to be profitable in the long term and sustain that effort, that's what makes the difference in the Vanguard companies.
Rosabeth, is there anything else you'd like to add about your book or about your research?
I just want to say that this is deeply pragmatic. It sounds idealistic because I'm talking about values and principles, but Procter & Gamble, for example, is highly successful for over 170 years. They make very shrewd and smart business decisions, but they also do it with an understanding of the importance of values and principles. So you don't have to give up being a hard-nosed business person. I'm thinking this makes good business sense. It's also, of course, something that we care about as human beings. I think that matters to just about everybody. because we're not just making a living, we're also making a life. And everybody from the average worker to top management has to go to work every day with excitement and a sense of mission and purpose. That's what sustains them as they build great products to sell into great markets.
The name of the book is Supercorp, How Vanguard Companies Create Innovation, Profits, Growth, and Social Good. And we've been speaking to the author, Rosabeth Moss Cantor. Thanks, Rosabeth.
Thank you very much.
As always, we'd love to get your feedback. So please drop us an email at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.